I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Today, we're learning more about the horrific shooting at Pulse, a gay club in Orlando, Florida, early Sunday morning. 49 people were killed and scores were wounded, making it the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. The shooter, Omar Mateen, who was killed by a police SWAT team, reportedly claimed allegiance to ISIS in a call to 911 and had been investigated several times by the FBI for possible ties to terrorists because of comments he had made. We begin our conversation this morning with Jeff Brady. He's in Orlando. A correspondent for NPR has been reporting for NPR on the story. And Jeff, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for inviting me.
Jeff, have all the victims been identified as of this morning?
They have not. That's been a very difficult process, clearly. I just finished counting. The city has a website where they're listing the names of people who have died after they've notified next of kin. And currently that list has about 33 names on it. A lot were added this morning, but there are 49 victims here. So 49 minus 33, there are still 16 people who they have to go out and find their next of kin. They've got a team of people trying to do that.
I noticed that the number was reduced from 50 to 49. I don't want to make a big deal of it. Is that just because of the carnage and the difficulty of identifying victims?
Well, you know, actually, it was a little bit of confusion about there are 50 people who are dead, but one of those is the shooter. And so there are 49 victims, one shooter, a total of 50 people dead.
Tell us about Pulse, this nightclub. Seems like a very popular nightclub in Orlando. Then I do want to talk about just the horribleness of what happened on Sunday morning.
Yeah, this nightclub is really a center of the gay community here in Orlando. It was started by a woman, sort of a commemoration to her brother who died of AIDS in the early 1990s. And it was not just a place where people went to party. It was a central piece of the gay community here. And on Sunday night, or pardon me, Saturday night, it was Latin night. And when you look at that list, the names of the people who are dead, there are a lot of Latino names in there. And just even looking through the list, you don't have their individual stories on that list. But it's just heartbreaking when you read the ages next to each of those victims. I saw there was one man who was 19 years old. Mm. Most of the victims are in their 20s and 30s. These are young people.
And this is also Pride Month. June is Pride Month. There were events here in Philadelphia and in other parts across the country over the weekend and during the month.
Yeah, this is a really important time. I mean, it's called Pride Month, you know, to be proud of being your authentic self. And people who showed up at a club like this were being their authentic self. And to be attacked in that situation where you might already feel a little bit vulnerable, this was an especially sensitive time, I think, because it is Pride Month.
Well, I do want to walk through what happened because I just think it's important to know what happened that early Sunday morning. What time did Omar Mateen, what time did he enter this club?
It was just after 2 o'clock in the morning, so we're talking early Sunday morning here, and there was an Orlando police officer. He was in a uniform and working at the Pulse. They some sort of arrangement there for security, I guess, for officers working in off hours. And he was the first to, that officer was the first to respond to the shots fired. And then other officers showed up. There were 11 in total who exchanged fire with the attacker right at that 2 o'clock moment. And then as those 11 officers rushed into this building, they kind of forced the gunman into a bathroom. The gunman took 4 to 5 hostages with him. And next door in another bathroom, there were about 12 to 15 people who were believed to be in there. And that was kind of a calm period in all of this until around 5 o'clock in the morning. Police, the SWAT team, they were trying to negotiate with the shooter. The police this morning said that the shooter was not making many demands. All the demands were coming from the police side. But there was this sort of standoff for a couple of hours, and then things started heating up, and he said he had a vest on, and there was talks of explosives, and so police made a decision to break through a cement wall that went into one of those bathrooms. And you can look on our website on NPR.org. You'll see pictures where you see three holes. They weren't able to breach that cement wall at first, so they kind of rammed it with some sort of vehicle. And that allowed a lot of those people in the adjacent bathroom to escape. They say there must have been people still inside the club, because they say about 30 people escaped through this hole made in the wall. And then the shooter himself came out through one of those holes, and there was another gunfight, and that's when the shooter was killed. Mm.
And do we know the hostages that the shooter was holding in the bathroom? Did he kill them? Were they able to escape, Jeff?
Yeah, we don't know if specifically if they are among the 49 victims who are dead or the 53 people who are wounded.
Now, he did have an AR-15-style assault rifle. He also had a handgun. Do we know how he was able to enter this bar armed as he was? Do we know if he had, I mean, an AR-15 is a pretty big gun, or rifle, I should say. Was he able to hide the fact that he was armed?
Yeah, we don't have that right now. We don't know if he walked in with the weapons hidden or walked in with, you know, guns literally blazing. We do know that to get to this particular nightclub, he drove a couple of hours, because he lived down in Fort Pierce, Florida, which is about 2 hours south of Orlando. But what happened at that exact moment when he arrived, we don't know. But shortly after that, there was a gun battle with that first uniformed officer who was already at the club, and then with the other 11 officers who showed up.
And an officer was shot, right? Not killed, but wounded?
Yeah, there's this stunning picture that the police have tweeted out. The officer was wearing a Kevlar helmet. Kevlar is this material that is supposed to make it more difficult for a bullet to pierce it. And you can see the hole in the side of this helmet, where obviously if he had not been wearing that helmet, that officer would be dead. But the police say he's pretty much fine, and that helmet definitely saved his life.
Now, there's some question about this call to 911, or maybe just sort of the timing of that call. Jeff, do we know when Omar Mateen made that call?
Yeah, he made that call during that sort of calm period while he was in the bathroom. So after that initial round of shooting, went into the bathroom, at some point he made that call to 911. And during that call, we were told that he pledged allegiance to the Islamic State.
And do we know if anything or what the police department did after that call?
I don't think that call was necessarily what escalated things to the point where they felt like they needed to break down that wall, to put explosives on that wall and put a hole in the wall. It sounds like it was more that there was this kind of escalation that was happening, and there was talk of explosives. It sounds like that on the part of the shooter, like maybe he had something else, but it was clear to the police that he was going to injure more people soon, and that's why they felt like they had to take action. But there's one other thing here that I want to think
sure.
about for just a second, because
sure.
imagine being the police chief. You know that this man has walked into a bar. You know that a lot of people have already been shot just after 2 o'clock in the morning. And then you're sitting there for 2 hours negotiating with this guy when you would really want to be helping those people. But they had to make that choice to kind of go forward as they did. It was always this calculation of, you know, how many people, what action is going to save the most people. And they had to let some of those people stay in there and not receive medical attention.
Speaking of that, something like, 53 people wounded? Jeff, do we know the status of them and how serious some of them are wounded or injured?
Yeah, it sounds like some of those are very serious. I have to say that hasn't been a part of the story that I've been working a lot on, so I pretty much just know that 53 people are wounded. I don't know specifics about that. I do want to talk about this hotel where we're
staying. Ask you about that. Yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah. So what happens when a story breaks, and you know NPR doesn't have people everywhere. We're all located at different places around the country, and so we had people from New York and me in Philadelphia and folks from Los Angeles and Tucson and coming into Orlando here, and of course from DC. And so the first thing we all do is we make reservations at a hotel, because people with bigger budgets than us can fill up a hotel really quickly. So we all do that individually as quickly as we can. So we found a hotel very close to this club. Turns out it was the hotel where the family members were gathering, and police were delivering the news about who was injured and who was dead. And when I arrived yesterday afternoon, it was just an extraordinary sight. First, outside at the in front of the front doors in the kind of covered area, there was a prayer vigil going on. Large group of people holding hands and praying. And so I walked past that, went into the front doors, and the lobby was just filled with people crying, hugging. It was just a scene of complete suffering. I've seen a lot of things, and it just seeing that many people in that state of suffering was it was just really sad.
No, I think we're all feeling that with you, Jeff. And of course, you know, putting ourselves in the shoes of people waiting to hear that news, and as you said, not knowing, we don't have the total number of names of people who actually died at Pulse.
Right. And at some point, you know, they're coming in and listing, like, okay, here are the people who are injured. So if you're sitting there and you still haven't heard your family member's name, do you assume that they're dead?
Right.
Or you have to hold some sort of hope? But that's the kind of excruciating experience that those people were having yesterday.
Jeff, we're almost out of time here. So what happens today? I'm assuming more identifications, more investigations into the shooter, Omar Mateen?
Yeah, the priority is to find the next of kin for those remaining victims. They've removed all of the bodies. There's an investigation underway. The U.S. attorney here says if anyone else is involved in this crime, they're going to be prosecuted. But he also said that they don't believe that there's any harm to the public for anyone else who might be connected to this crime.
Well, we have to end on that note. Jeff Brady, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Jeff Brady, again, joining us from Orlando, Florida. He's been reporting on the mass shooting for National Public Radio for NPR. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation talking about what happened Sunday morning in Orlando at Pulse. You have read about it. You have heard about it. And we have two more guests who'll be joining us right after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
We know enough to say that this was an act of terror and an act of hate. And as Americans, we are united in grief, in outrage, and in resolve to defend our people.
That was President Obama speaking yesterday about the mass shooting in Orlando, Florida, early Sunday morning, the deadliest in the country's history. Omar Mateen was killed by a police SWAT team after a several-hour standoff at Pulse, a popular gay nightclub. Mateen was 29 years old, an American citizen, the son of Afghan immigrants, had been investigated by the FBI several times and worked as a security guard. He had called 911 yesterday, pledging allegiance to ISIS. We now want to focus on homegrown terrorism and radicalization, and we have two guests who have joined us. Karen Greenberg joins us from the NPR studios in New York. She's director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. She's actually got a new book called Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. Karen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Very nice to be here.
Also with us is Mark Potok. He's a senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center, editor-in-chief of the center's quarterly journal called The Intelligence Report. And Mark, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Karen, let me begin with you, and I want to get into a lot of the details here, but just sort of a moment to acknowledge just the horror of what happened yesterday in Orlando, Florida. The fact that 49 people were killed by a lone shooter, at least as we understand at this point. And I just would like to hear your thoughts.
You know, the largest mass killing in American history. More people died in the attack than in all collective, domestic terrorism attacks in the name of Islamic fundamentalism since 9/11. And it's just a tragedy of immense proportions and something we're going to have to give a lot of time and thought to in terms of how to go forward because, it involved hate crime. It involved some form of mention of ISIS. It involved assault weapons, so many vulnerable, sensitive points that our political system has made it very difficult to find our way around and through these issues.
And I want to pick up on all that. Mark, let me just give you a chance to respond, say whatever you've been thinking in the last 24 hours.
Well, it's a complete horror, and the picture painted by your reporter of that hotel lobby is something that sticks with you for a long time. I mean, I, as a reporter many years ago, covered the massacre that took place in a Luby's restaurant in Killeen, Texas. So I've been at a kind of smaller version of this, as well as covering, of course, Oklahoma City. I mean, just a terrible, terrible horror. And, the other thing I would say about it is quite apart from the Islamist aspect of this, is, what the LGBT community in America must be feeling today. They are under attack. Part of the work that we've done over the last years is looking at who are most targeted in terms of hate crime, putting terrorism aside for a moment. What we found was that LGBT people, this is based on about 14, 15 years of FBI data, are more than twice as likely to be attacked in a violent hate crime as Jews or black people, more than four times as likely as Muslims, and almost 14 times as likely as Latinos. So although LGBT people in this country have made really stunning advances in the last couple of decades, there is always right underneath the surface this threat. It's maybe worth recalling that on New Year's Eve of 2013, a man in Seattle tried to burn alive 750 gay people in an upstairs club. He poured gasoline on the stairs, set it on fire, and no one was hurt, but that was merely thanks to very, very quick-thinking patrons who smelled smoke, found the fire, and managed to put it out before all of those people were murdered.
Karen, let me go back to you and picking up on some of the things that you had mentioned. What we are learning about this man is, and obviously we do not know everything, and we must say that throughout the conversation, but he appeared to be, as much as he called 911 yesterday, there's about ISIS and his loyalty to ISIS. There's some question about whether he was recruited or whether he's one of these sort of lone, self-radicalized shooters.
Right. We don't know what we're going to know in the future. What it looks like now and the way it's being reported is that he was a lone shooter who decided at the very end, if not before, we don't know anything about the before, to invoke the name of ISIS, which I would say is a very different thing than being recruited by ISIS, doing something in the name of ISIS, etc. And so what we have here is another mass shooting in the United States, some of which invoke ISIS, some of which invoke hate, some of which don't invoke anything. And it really makes us want to think through what can be done to prevent these kinds of horrors.
Well, what do you think can be done?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is a ban on assault weapons. The amount of, we were just talking about the smoke that was detected in the club in Seattle that saved all those lives. If somebody has a knife or even a pistol, the damage that can be done with an assault weapon is so much greater. And So, I mean, these are just little things. They may not change radicalization. They may not change a person's freaking out and committing an act of violence, or a person's, you know, carrying out some planned violence, but it certainly would lessen the amount of damage. I think a second thing that really we have to think about as a society is what we do to help people with mental illness. And I know it's very hard after a tragedy like this to talk about helping anybody who has done something so horrific. But the fact is that the correlation between mental illness and people who are able to do violence and able to get guns needs to be thought about in a constructive way. And I think one thing we've learned, there's been a lot of focus on the FBI. You'll see in the reports, they talked to this person 2 years ago and 3 years ago, and why didn't they continue to surveil him? Who knows what he could have done in the future? This is asking law enforcement for things, A, they can't do, and B, we don't want them to do. And therefore, there has to be another approach. And I think that this country has to wake up and to say, look, civil society has to step in here. There have got to be resources that are available to families, to individuals who have some form of mental instability or sickness. They need to be taken care of in a way that will make the rest of us better taken care of. And we've focused an awful lot on the preventive aspects of, you know, if you say something in one direction about ISIS or al-Qaeda, then maybe you're a danger. But what about the people, vast majority of whom, the people that have attracted to ISIS belong in this category, who are just lost individuals who are unable to restrain themselves, and they need to have some kind of resource to go to, and we don't have it as a society.
Let me play. This is FBI Special Agent Ron Hopper. This was a press briefing yesterday where he talked about the several times that the FBI had been contacted about the gunman, about Omar Mateen. Let's give it a listen, and then, Mark, I'll give you a chance to respond.
The FBI first became aware of Mateen in 2013 when he made inflammatory comments to coworkers alleging possible terrorist ties. The FBI thoroughly investigated the matter, including interviews of witnesses, physical surveillance, and records checks. In the course of the investigation, Mateen was interviewed twice. Ultimately, we were unable to verify the substance of his comments, and the investigation was closed. In 2014, Mateen again came to the attention of the FBI because of possible ties to Monar Abu Salah, an American suicide bomber. The FBI conducted an investigation, including an interview with Mateen. We determined that contact was minimal and did not constitute a substantive relationship or a threat at that time.
Mark, can you weigh in on that? And there's been much discussion about what the FBI did. We don't know the content of the conversation that they had with Omar Mateen, but you can have violent ideas and thoughts in this country and not get arrested. Can you sort of weigh in with your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that what Karen said is right. The FBI can't, as a constitutional matter, follow around every person in the country who has unpleasant ideas or thoughts or expresses ideologies that some of us may not agree with. And as a practical matter, they can't do it simply because of the incredible person power required. So, you know, I think she's right. I think, you know, the two things that you can get your kind of hands around are assault weapons and the treatment of mental illness. I don't think there's much question about that. You know, one thing I would add in, which we haven't spoken about, is without trying to attach the blame for a mass murder on politicians and others kind of in the political mainstream, a big piece, it seems to me, of what's happening, maybe not in this particular case, but talking about hate crime and terrorism in general, is the incredible vitriol that we see in the political mainstream. I'm talking about bans on Muslims and rapist Mexicans and all the rest of it. And it's certainly not limited to Donald Trump, although he's sort of apotheosized the whole thing. So, you know, there is a really an incredible amount of noxious and hateful speech out there. And that's not just an unpleasantness. I mean, who's to say with this shooter? But for many people, I mean, one thing we see with hate criminals very often is that they do want to feel justified in what they're doing. So, you know, when some quote-unquote news site or something like that on the Internet tells these people that what they're thinking is correct, that gay people, for instance, are, you know, of the devil or whatever it may be, that matters.
Karen, let me pick up on several things. And one is the father of Omar Mateen said that from his knowledge of his son, he didn't think that he had any particular connection or association to ISIS. But what seemed to upset him was seeing two men kissing, I'm assuming kissing in public. And we haven't really talked with you about that part of this in unfolding and ongoing story. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, there's two parts of your question. One is, how much do we credit the father here? I think that one thing that nobody's ever written about or thought about that we've done a little bit of research on is the connection between parents and individuals who carry out these kinds of crimes, and Mark may know more about it. But it's hard for them to know what to say after an incident like this. It's hard to know exactly. So I just think it's the kind of thing where, yeah, that may make sense in that he attacked a gay club, but I don't think we can make much more of it than that. I think that the deeper issue here is what Mark was talking about, which is how do we as a society square our desire to keep people safe and to keep our children safe and our embrace of all of the freedoms that we have and make sure that we protect them so that how can people spout hatred and yet look what happens when hatred is spouted and given some kind of life of its own, like by our political candidates. And I think that the missing piece here is a sense of responsibility on the part of all of us to sort of be better human beings. And I know that sounds like a very idealistic thing, but this is not a society that has control of itself. And so I think that's the deeper disturbing part of what's going on today.
Karen, let me pick up on something. Apparently, the co-workers of Omar Mateen had gone to the FBI, it sounds like several times, to say, you know, we're told to, if you see something, say something, which they did. And again, the FBI, you know, looked through, talked to him, perhaps checked out some of his associations and seemed to think that at least as it stood then, this was 2013 and 2014, he passed their test. I know your book, Rogue Justice, is about the concerns that you have that by keeping us safe, we might give up some of our freedoms. But how do you struggle with that? It looks like everyone, in a sense, tried to do their job.
Yeah, that's actually very, very interesting and sort of troubling to me, in that one of the things that critics of the FBI, and I think a lot of the work they do is very responsible and very good, but one of the things we have seen is an overreaching into who might be a terrorist suspect. And one of the problems with that approach is that you really don't know who might be, and it's a question of resources. The FBI is a third of the size of the NYPD, and that's for all of its activities, including global. So you have to be incredibly attuned, and your judgment has to be incredibly good about who to actually spend your resources on. And so I would say, you know, they're going to do a lot of more investigation into exactly what happened with those reports, but it's definitely problematic. And let me add this one other thing that I'm very concerned with in the book and in general, which is that we have learned in the United States after 9/11 that more is better. The more people you detain, the more people that you put on a watch list, the more people that you suspect, the safer we're going to be. It's not true. What the fact is that the more focused we are, the more particularized we are, the more individuated we are about suspicion, the safer we're going to be. And I'm guessing that when we get to the bottom of this investigation, that theory is going to prove valid and valuable.
Mark, what do we need to know about what are described as homegrown radicals, or specifically looking at Omar Mateen, born in the United States, the son of immigrants from Afghanistan, was married for a while. We're hearing it sounds like it was a troubled relationship. His wife said that he was abusive to her. The family seemed to think that, you know, that things were okay, at least the day before this horrible event. But what do we need to know about how someone gets radicalized and living in the United States?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a big question, and there are a lot of studies going on, many of them funded by the Department of Justice, looking at exactly that question. How are people radicalized, especially in this kind of lone wolf fashion? You know, I'm not sure this is directly responding to your question, but, I mean, I think one of the things that's occurring out there is this very wholesale move toward, I mean, this has happened over the course of decades, but this very strong move towards lone wolf terrorism as opposed to other kinds. That's been true for many, many years of the domestic radical right. I'm talking about sort of white supremacists and neo-Nazis and those kinds of groups. Back in the 80s, there was a famous essay written by a Klansman named Lewis Beam on leaderless resistance, which is essentially another name for lone wolf terrorism, the idea that we on the extreme right should not be building large pyramidical organizations because if one of us is busted in some way, we will be destroyed. You know, what's been interesting and I think an important trend is that not only are the vast majority of radical right-wing domestic terrorists lone wolves these days, but increasingly that's true of jihadists in this country. You know, Peter Bergen wrote a piece that was published this morning, a terrorism expert, pointing out that that was true of virtually all jihad, all the Islamist attacks in which people have died since 9/11. They were all carried out by lone wolves. And certainly, you know, of course, we don't know much about this shooter, but I would say certainly it appears that he acted on his own, you know, made this last second call to ISIS, and ISIS, of course, was happy to claim him as one of their own. You know, I just think that that is the problem we grapple with. And unfortunately, for all of us, lone wolves are by definition the most difficult kind of person to prevent from acting for obvious reasons.
And I will pick up on that after this very short break. That's Mark Potok from the Southern Poverty Law Center, Karen Greenberg from the Center on National Security at Fordham University Law School. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We are talking about what the country is talking about this morning, the shooting in Orlando at Pulse nightclub. 49 people killed, 53 injured, the largest, most destructive mass shooting in this country's history. And again, talking with Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law, also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Her new book is called Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. Mark Potok, senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center, editor-in-chief of the Southern Poverty Law Center's quarterly journal called The Intelligence Report. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just read a website comment from Stephen. He says, why do NPR and other news organizations refer to this as the terrorist attack on U.S. soil with the largest number of casualties when Oklahoma City bombing claimed 168 lives? And just for you, Stephen, and just to make sure our listeners know, we are talking about a shooting attack. Of course, that was a bomb that blew up the Oklahoma City bombing. But it does, Karen, you know, when you begin to add some of these things up, going back to that bombing probably before, also what happened in San Bernardino, what happened in Newtown at that elementary school, at movie theaters. The president talked about this yesterday. I mean, do we need to sort of acknowledge and accept the fact that we are a country that's going to have to learn to live with this level of mass shooting?
I have to answer no. I don't believe that that would be a good – first, let me respond to what that comment said about Oklahoma City. I think that's really good. If I didn't qualify it, I meant to qualify it by saying Islamist or Islamic fundamentalist inspired, because, you know, we're always learning – you know, we're always hearing in the headlines about terrorism and terrorism attacks by Islamist groups. And I was distinguishing those from, let's say, the fuller spectrum that Mark covers at the Southern Poverty Law Center. In terms of getting used to being in a society where these kinds of mass casualties will occur, I would absolutely not want to make that bargain. I don't think our leaders should make that bargain or get complacent about it. I think what it does is saying, look, we need to rethink how we're going about this. And one of the ways we need to rethink it is to not think of a terrorism in this country as being something that is Islamist inspired. And just because it intersects with the rhetoric or the leather jacket of the year for the name of killing, whose name you're doing killing in, we need to understand that this society is increasingly violent, and that violence is being carried out by people who are emotionally unstable, who have access to guns, who are in their 20s, who are male, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we need to pay attention and provide the kind of help that can deter this. So I absolutely would not sign on to, yes, let's just accept this.
Mark, how do you get to engaging someone with their ideology? I mean, obviously, deeply held ideology, and even if it's tied in with some, you know, mental issues as well, and get them to think differently about whether it's gay people or whether it's about our Western culture here. How do you intervene under those circumstances?
It's incredibly difficult, and there's quite a bit of experience at this point showing that that's so. You know, we run into fairly frequently people who have been, neo-Nazi skinheads on that scene for many years, who want to leave. But, you know, what we found time and time again is that it is very, very difficult to bring people to that point when they're not ready. So almost everybody who I know who has come out of the movement, the white supremacist movement, are people who've had some bad experience or who have just seen too much ugliness. And in one case, I know of a former leader of an important hate group who simply quit the scene because he had a young son who he did not want to grow up in this incredibly violent and ugly world. But as far as bringing people to that place by some kind of external intervention, I would say that by and large, we and other people engaged in this world have not been terribly successful. You know, there's an important fledgling organization called Life After Hate, which is composed of three or four people who did come out of the racist, the white supremacist world. But I think their experiences have been very much the same as ours, that it's only after the person has started to move away from that world that you can help them. And even then, it often takes people years to really kind of leave that life behind them. So I'm not filled with answers, unfortunately. It's a very tough thing to do.
I understand.
And I don't think there's been a lot of success.
Karen, we have a question from Linda. She says, why was this person able to buy any guns at all if they were on an FBI watch list? Now, we know that he was investigated several times by the FBI. I read one account where he was on an FBI watch list. But how do we make sense of that?
Yeah, I've read several accounts, and I don't know exactly what kind of watch list he was on. He was not on, you know, the major, you know, can't travel, no fly list, etc. So we really don't know. What we do know is that he was on their radar. Every person who's on the FBI radar is not going to be denied access to a gun. The amount of, you know, the thousands of investigations they do every year tells you that it can't be done in that way. There's going to have to be sort of massive overhaul of our gun laws, and it's not just access to guns, it's the access to assault weapons. And that's a very different thing. And the fact that anybody has access to assault weapons is kind of interesting. I wanted to follow up, if
sure.
it's okay, on something Mark said.
Sure.
As he said, there's been a number of sort of attempts to figure out what de-radicalizes people from any kind of radicalization. And there's been fascinating attempts all around the world to try to do this. And one of the things that has shown to be the case is children. What he said about, you know, having a son, that having a family and having a family that you want to have a coherent and positive existence in the world is extremely important. But I want to push back a little bit on the fact that the idea is to get at people before they develop this kind of hatred. And what's the idea that there's just not enough in the country to give hope and a future to so many swaths of individuals is really somewhat worrisome. And so I want to begin at that point, which is to say we really have to think about those who feel like they are not just the have-nots, right. but they are the have-nots forever, and that generationally they're going to stay that way. And this is a pivotal moment for the United States in thinking about how to address that issue of opportunity still being alive in America.
What do you think of that, Mark?
I think that's true. And a kind of related thought, I think that, you know, one of the problems in terms of the Muslim community in America that I've heard quite a lot about, and I'm sure Karen has as well, is how intimidated many people in that community feel by the FBI and other agencies. You know, what the story I've sort of heard many times is how, you know, young men are approached and really pushed hard to become informants against their own community, that kind of thing, in a way that is not, you know, it's not something that they're happy to do, right? They're frightened into doing this or bullied into doing it in some way, or at least that's the attempt. And that causes these enormous levels of resentment in the Muslim community. And I think it's certainly true that some of the you know, supposed plots, Islamist plots in this country, have been very largely the functions of FBI stings. It's been questionable in a number of cases if the people arrested really would have done what they are accused of doing, absent the undercover agent or informants. So that's another problem with all of this, and it seems to me it relates to Karen's point of you know, trying to make people feel that they are a part of the country and a part of its promise, and not, as in, say, France or someplace like that, sort of consigned to the ghetto.
Well, and picking up on what you both just said, but Karen, going back to you, then we'll get some callers in on the conversation. The people that don't feel part of this country, we, of course, are in the throes or the middle of a presidential race. And I just have to say it's really disturbing to think that there can't be, you know, 24 or 48 hours before there's finger pointing going on, and we can't sort of mourn together, frankly, as a country, and then sort of figure out what we have to do to deal with our problems. But I'd just be curious about your thoughts.
Yeah, my thoughts are that we are not Europe yet. And that this is a very important thing to not become in terms of its defiance against inclusiveness of Muslims. And France has got, you know, allowed a policy in which it is very hard for Muslim immigrants to advance inside the society economically and otherwise. And we have to be very careful not to ostracize that or any other community. And so remember, these ISIS cases in the United States, including this one, are American citizens. They're born here. They're raised here. They're educated here. We're talking about Americans. We're not talking and we want to make them have a stake in the society and not exist apart from it. And we're not there, but we don't want to go down that path.
I thought we had Michael to join the conversation, but it looks like we just lost him. Mark, do you want to add anything to what Karen just said there?
No, I just think it's very true. I mean, it's certainly not only France. I mean, you know, we see these things going on in Switzerland, banning the building of minarets, you know, the incredible anti-refugee animus in places like Hungary, you know, building fences and passing laws and so on. So, you know, I do agree that Europe is in a worse spot than we are. And we also generally have a much less, in terms of Islamists, a far less radicalized population than the Europeans do. But we're, as Karen suggests, you know, we're at a critical juncture. This can't go on. And, you know, it is not encouraging to see someone like Donald Trump patting himself on the back for having predicted this, you know, congratulating himself. I mean, it's really kind of appalling. And, you know, it's being used already a day later in order to, you know, to help him get elected president. It's, you know, it really is just appalling.
Go ahead, Karen. Sounds like you want to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say that one of the things that I've given a lot of thought to, and I'm sure Mark has too, is fear. What we have not learned as a country since 9/11 is how to manage our fear. And we still are not there. And so an incident like this just, you know, allows fears and statements like Donald Trump's to just burst out and to get people to acknowledge them and sort of draw within. And it's we need individuals who can calm the American people down, who can put in place policies that are constructive and not just punitive, and to really think about this, because we have not managed fear well, and we all know just how dangerous that can be. And so that's another piece of this challenge we haven't mentioned.
Well, let me pick up on that, Karen, and also to you, Mark, and talking about what President Obama said yesterday. I don't know how many times he has, you know, gone to the Rose Garden to talk about yet another mass shooting in this country. But Karen, what more can the president do or say?
I think he did a pretty good job. I think, you know, he identified it as a hate crime. He identified it as terrorism in its broadest sense without, you know, pointing to what it was. He mentioned the gun issue and the assault weapon issue. I think that those are constructive acts to take. The other thing he can do is to follow up on his words, which I think he will do, which is to really push for gun background checks, for being very careful about who gets a gun, for banning assault weapons, I would hope. And so that's what he needs to do, is to follow up on his words. And my guess is he will.
Mark, let me just add to that a comment from Paul, who says, what exactly is a law that applies when a person asks a gun dealer to sell him an assault weapon? Does it vary state to state, or is it federal law? Picking up what Karen said, but also just what you would say back to Paul, our listener, can you weigh in on that?
I'm not sure I understood the question about how. Say it to me again, if you would, please.
Well, I think the question was, can, assuming you're not on a terror watch list and you can legally buy a gun in the United States, can anyone go into a gun shop and buy an assault weapon?
Well, anyone who is not a convicted felon, you know, pretty much that's true. And in most states, you can buy an assault weapon without, or a semi-automatic assault weapon, without a waiting period at all. So it really is, you know, it's not a good situation. If I could say something on another topic, I just want to add to what Karen said a little bit, that, you know, all of these things are things, you know, some things we talked about that can be done. I think Obama did well yesterday, too. But it is maybe worth remembering that, you know, in the largest context, we as a country and Western society in general are going through an incredibly huge transition. I mean, this country is changing demographically in a really dramatic way. Whites, who have been 90% of the population since the colonial era, are at about 62% now and slated to lose their majority in the next 30 years or so. You know, at the same time, we have historic levels of income inequality, you know, long-running declines in manufacturing wages. It's tougher and tougher for people out there who are not educated enough. I mean, if you're trying to find a job with only a high school degree, you're only in trouble. So all of these things at the same time, you know, very major cultural changes happening, things like the advance of same-sex marriage. So people are unmoored. You know, many people feel, you know, this is not the country I grew up in. This is not the country my Christian white forefathers created. Those kinds of things. So there's just an enormous amount of anger and fear, real rage out there. And then on top of all of this, in part thanks to the structure of the sort of new media, but in part for other reasons, we see this incredible hatred expressed by mainstream figures in the society, politicians and pastors and pundits and so on.
Well, we do have to end our conversation on that note. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Mark Potok, Senior Fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Karen Greenberg, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law. She's got a new book called Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State, joining us from the NPR studios in New York. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.